Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would happen if we could control technology simply by thinking about it? Healthy people use thought to control voluntary movements of their bodies, which are, after all, a sort of biological machine. And now scientists are working toward designing synthetic systems that might someday restore the power to move at will to those with paralysis and control that movement not by switches or keyboards, but by signals emitted from our brains. Miguel Nicolelis is at the forefront of such research. He is professor of neuroscience and founder of the Center for Neuroengineering at Duke University. He writes about his ongoing work in his new book, Beyond Boundaries, The New Neuroscience of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Miguel, welcome to Think.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Before we talk about how neurons might communicate with human-built machines, we ought to talk about how neurons and brain structures work with one another. The theory used to be that these systems acted discreetly, I guess. Can you talk about how the study of the brain changes when we focus instead on how they all interact?
Yeah, for the past 70, 80 years, neuroscientists have been listening to the electrical signals produced by brain cells. And we started listening to one cell at a time, you know, recording these electrical signals and trying to decode the messages that they produce. But in the last, 20 years, we acquired the capability of listening to hundreds, thousands of cells simultaneously, and we, you know, start changing the views we have on how brain circuits interact and how they produce from, you know, sheer electricity and a few chemicals, all the behaviors, all the memories, all the feelings, the emotions, everything that a human being does in his life out of this, you know, raw material. And now we have been able to, you know, read this thinking activity in real time and translate these thoughts into action to some degree.
And you share this great story about how in your own life, witnessing Brazil's transition to democracy reinforced the importance of considering the way neurons all contribute simultaneously to brain function.
Yeah, that was a kind of a nice metaphor because when I was growing up in Brazil and the country was making this transition to, you know, democracy, I participated into one of the largest political rallies ever in the history of Brazil and probably in the world, with a million people come to a square to basically ask for the dictators to step down. And that showed me right there the power of populations of individuals acting together. You know, there were a few leaders of the movement, but it was the sheer power of many elements, many individuals working together in synchrony that made that movement succeed. So the same metaphor applies to the brain. There is no single neuron, single brain cell that controls anything that we do, any behavior. There is no neuronal dictator. You need a neuronal democracy to actually bring about any behavior, any action that a human will produce to interact with the world.
And that distribution of brain activity over a wide group of neurons, you say, essentially acts as a sort of insurance policy for our brains.
Yes. That's a very interesting thing that evolved as an insurance policy for the brain, because if you distributed a message across huge territories of the brain, small lesions, small losses of tissue will not produce any noticeable deficit or any noticeable lack of behavior. You have to have major mega lesions for, you know, some clinical symptom to appear. So we may be losing neurons every day after a certain age of our lives, but we don't notice any change because we have so many cells interacting together, and despite these losses, these remaining neurons can take over and execute the functions that we need to execute in our daily life.
So, Miguel, talk about what it takes to map the activity of particular regions to the brain to particular body parts or sensory functions.
Yeah, today we have many techniques to do that. Now, you can go to a hospital and sit in a magnet, and a neurologist, a radiologist will see activity from your entire brain. But, you know, different methods have different spatial and temporal resolutions. You can see, you know, with high spatial resolution, you can see close to individual groups of cells. But what you really need in addition to that is a very high temporal resolution, because the brain operates at a millisecond scale, 1,000th of a second. That's the time in which the electrical signals are produced in the brain. So for the last 28 years, I have been working on a technique that today allows us to map close to 1,000 brain cells simultaneously by reading the electrical signals produced by each one of them and then combining these brain, literally these brainstorms, into signals that can be translated into digital commands that a robot or a computer or even an avatar, a virtual avatar, can read and decode and execute the instructions that come from a particular brain.
You write here about the what we've learned from the sensation that many amputees have of phantom limbs. Can you talk about that and what we've learned from that about how the brain and the body interact?
Oh, yeah. That is one of the greatest and most mysterious phenomena neuroscience has, you know, tried to explain for centuries now. Basically, in a large percentage, close to 80 to 90% of people that lose a limb or a leg or arm, the person continues to feel the presence of that missing part of the body. So there are reports since the medieval ages, some of which were classified as miracles, because people would report that after losing an arm in a battlefield, many examples in the American Civil War, for instance, they continue to feel that piece of the body present, moving. And in a very large percentage of the patients, that missing part of the body was not only there, but it was painful. Mm-hmm. So that's a painful phantom limb. So if you can think about anything more surreal than not having a piece of your body there and you still feel pain and feel the sensation that that piece of the body is moving is something amazing. And when you see it as a clinician the first time, and I report that in the book, was a shock for me. Well, we now know that these sensations are created in the brain because the brain is the ultimate simulator. I like to say that is a perfect modeler. It creates a model of our bodies and is continuously playing this model so we have a feeling for what our body is. And even after we miss a piece of the body like that, that machinery, the neuronal machinery, continues to generate the sensations as if that part of the body was still present physically. So the challenge for medicine and neurology for hundreds of years has been how to accommodate the lack of these signals, the lack of that piece of the body, with the generation of these sensations that continue to be produced by the brain. And lately we have been learning that we actually have to fool the brain. We have to provide the brain with some illusion, like a mirror image of the other limb that is still present, so that the brain, when the patient looks and has this visual image of the piece of the body that is still remaining projected to the stump of the amputated limb, the patient thinks that there is a limb there, and that sensation, the funny sensation and the pain, goes away. So you actually have to interact with the brain because the brain has an active point of view.
Does that same system of the way the brain sort of creates our perception of what our limbs are doing, does that explain why we can swing a hammer pretty well and sort of understand how much space it's going to take up, even though it's not part of our bodies?
Oh, yeah, that's another very interesting phenomenon that can only be explained if you change our own perception of what the brain is doing. I propose a hypothesis here in the book, supported by many studies now, that every tool that we use, particularly tools that we use in our daily life, and tools that make us proficient, like a tennis player playing tennis or a soccer player playing soccer, or you using your hammer every day to build a house, that those tools are assimilated by the brain, by this modeler, this simulator, as an extension of our body. So the model that the brain built that defines what our body limits are is extended to assimilate that tool as an extension of, let's say, our hand. So when you play tennis after a while and you become a really good player or a good player, you are not anymore feeling that racket as a strange tool in your hand. It's like an extension of your arm. And in fact, if you ask players, very proficient players, to close their eyes and point after a game to where their hands end with the other hand, and you ask them to point, put the index finger on at the end of the other index finger to the hand that he uses to play with the racket, he's going to actually point at the end of the racket, where the racket should be, not to the other index finger. Because for him, for his brain, the body ends at the end of the racket. So same thing with our cars. And that may explain the way we drive, by the way. The cars have become part of us. We assimilate the cars as an extension of ourselves. And we actually defend that territory as if someone was, you know, about to challenge our existence on Earth. And that may explain why my countryman in São Paulo drives so crazily.
We've heard it's just the cabs. Maybe it's just the cabs.
Yes.
Talk about the work that's been done with monkeys. There was, to start, a sort of video game pioneer named Belle, who was this little owl monkey. Can you talk about the task she was given?
Oh, sure. Yeah. With the owl monkey, that was the first experiment on a primate that used its own brain activity to play a video game without moving the body, without actually using the body to control any device. So the raw electrical activity that was coding for the movements of a particular behavior, a particular motor behavior that is necessary to play a video game, was recorded from the brain of that animal, was combined, and was translated into digital commands that could move a robotic arm. And in the first experiment, we didn't close the loop. We didn't send signals back from the robotic arm to the monitor or to back to the animal so he could or she could have a feeling for what was going on. But a year later, we started playing with another monkey called Aurora that became, you know, the most famous monkey in this field that actually learned how to use its brain activity to control a computer cursor on a screen, to move this cursor to targets that appear randomly on the screen. And as she was doing that, she was learning to do this operation. She got rewarded. Every time she crossed the target, she got a drop of Brazilian orange juice. And, you know, monkeys will do anything for you, you know, for a drop of Brazilian orange juice. So we learned that we could record Aurora's brain activity as she learned to play the video game. And in a given moment, a few weeks afterwards, we send this brain activity to a robotic arm. And a robotic arm at that point started controlling the cursor movements on the screen. So Aurora could see that the cursor could be controlled by this robotic arm, so she completely stopped moving her own body and now started to play the video game just by thinking. And she achieved the same performance that she had when she was using her own hand to move the cursor. So that was when we knew that that could be done. That was really the first major demonstration that you could have this brain-machine interface operating under the control of the brain of the subject without any body movement whatsoever.
So why experiment on monkeys and not apply this to human beings yet?
Well, since you are developing a new method, a new technology, and frankly, you are learning how the brain operates under these conditions, you have to start, of course, these experiments in rats and monkeys to be sure that you know what you're doing, to understand the limits and how far you can take this technology, and to see one of the most important things, how safe and how long-lasting these recordings can be. So now we have acquired, you know, 10 years, 12 years now of data in animals. We know that these recordings can last for a long time. In primates, we have in some cases recorded the brains of primates for almost 7 years in a row. And we know that if we have enough neurons being recorded, if we have a mass of cells, we are getting close to 1,000 neurons now. We are hoping to get to tens of thousands of neurons in the next few years, that we would be able to use this technology to basically generate body movements, complete body movement from the brain of these patients. And that's our long-term goal.
My guess.
To restore mobility to patients that cannot move any longer because of lesions of the spinal cord, for instance.
My guest is Miguel Nicolelis. He is professor of neuroscience and founder of the Center for Neuroengineering at Duke University. His new book is Beyond Boundaries, the New Neuroscience of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Join us now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Miguel Nicolelis. His new book is called Beyond Boundaries, The New Science of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. You're invited to join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I think it's important to point out here, Miguel, that as much as everybody now loves Aurora, she's not some genius monkey. In fact, she had been sort of a washout before these experiments began.
Oh, yes, yes. She was at NIH, and she wouldn't work for many years. She wouldn't perform. So Aurora was actually a gift from a friend that never told me that she was not going to work. I guess he wanted to get rid of her. But we all fell in love with her, and I guess she fell in love with us because she became our, you know, leading primate in the colony, and she just loved to play the video game. So we have many movies of Aurora that have been shown all over the world, so she became a star neuroscientist all over the world.
How many neurons would have to be mapped in order to control something like full-body movement?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. As I said, we are recording close to, you know, 700 neurons right now, and we are very close to cross the 1,000-neuron boundary. But to get to where we want to be, and we have just 3 or 4 years to do that, we would need about tens of thousands of neurons, 20 to 30,000 neurons, to get a whole-body exoskeleton. That's a robotic vest for the whole body, or, you know, that a quadriplegic patient could wear to move. So to allow this person to regain mobility, to reach for objects, to feed herself or himself, to walk in normal terrain, to react to changes in the terrain. So we have calculated this, and we have now a new type of technology to record electrical signals from the brain that may get us there in the next couple of years.
Talk about the challenges of something like reacting to the terrain, because most of us who are healthy and are able to walk without thinking about it don't recognize how many calculations we're constantly making based not only on the ability to move our bodies, but on the sensation that we have from feeling our feet hit the ground.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the reason this thing that we call a neuroprosthetic device, a cortical neuroprosthetic device, for whole body control would require not only a motor component, that is to make the body move, but we require also sensors all over this vest that will send feedback information back to the brain and actually directly to the brain, because if you have damage to the spinal cord, let's say a high cervical thoracic lesion, you also lose the ability to sense the world. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to feel when you touch the ground. So this vest will have sensors all over it that will send information back to the brain directly, and we already have a method for doing that. We already tested that in primates, and it worked. So that to do exactly what you said, as the patient is touching the ground, it has to acquire very quickly information about that terrain and the position of the leg and the rest of the body in relation to the terrain to be able to maintain balance, to be able to react to changes in that terrain.
Would the technology also have implications for dealing with nerve pain, which, as I understand it, lingers sometimes for years in quadriplegics and paraplegics who can't feel things but still will feel pains in the limbs that they've lost sensation in?
Yes, it's related to what we discussed a few minutes ago on phantom limb pain. And that's a very interesting question. Since now we know, and most of us believe, that most of this pain may be generated centrally in the central nervous system, in the machinery that designs this model of what our bodies are, we hope that there will be ways to stimulate these regions of the brain, particularly when this robotic vest is activated and is moving the patient, that will give to the brain the feeling or the sensation that there is a body there and this body is acting, and that this new body is fulfilling the predictions and expectations that the model that the brain created is requesting to say, okay, my body is fine, the body is there. So that's part of our research, is to see how we can fool the brain by creating a new body, an artificial body, that fulfills the criteria that the brain sets aside to claim, okay, I can relax now. I know that my body is present.
Talk a little bit about the relationships between the neuroscience folks and the engineers putting together these exoskeletons or different technologies, and how you've had to learn to speak each other's language.
Yeah, that's also a very interesting development that is very recent. The Center for Neuroengineering at Duke, for instance, was one of the first centers that got together neuroscientists, engineers, computer scientists, physicists to work together. And this was not easy because, as you said, everybody has, you know, his or her own language, jargon, way of thinking. So I think the best example of this collaboration is this project, this non-profit consortium that we have created called the Walk Again Project. That is, you know, a consortium of American, particularly Duke University, European and Brazilian universities that are interacting together, putting, you know, engineers, roboticists, mathematicians, neuroscientists, psychologists, neurosurgeons, working an international team to come to the final goal of making a human being walk again using a brain-machine interface. This has been a wonderful experience because we have to learn to work together. We have to set aside our individual fields and start learning how to communicate our ideas to audiences that, for instance, never heard about the brain before, or like ourselves, neuroscientists that never worked with robotics before. And this merging of these disciplines is making neuroscience become one of the ultimate multidisciplinary fields of our time. And that's what neuroengineering is about, is this marriage of many disciplines.
Sort of like the way the brain works together from all its different systems.
Pretty much. In fact, that's part of one of the theories that we have, that the social, political, and economic macrostructures that we see in the world actually reflect the intrinsic machinery of our brains. The intrinsic machinery of how our brains operate have been somehow projected to the way we have our social, political, and economic interactions.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak on the phones now to Io in Denton. Hi, Io.
Yeah, hi. I'm a big fan of Think. I think to live and I live to think. That's me. Okay, my question is, I want to know how much this German philosopher, Martin Heidegger, has influenced scientific understanding of the human brain and consciousness. Because Heidegger was telling us that consciousness is more or less an activity of the brain. So he doesn't want to think that there's something distinctive called the soul or the mind. And I know this is a perennial problem of philosophy, problem of mind and body. Is there really a mind or a soul? Thank you.
Thanks for calling. I don't know. We had kind of a poor connection, Miguel, but he was asking about the influence of Martin Heidegger.
Well, yes, I think he was asking about the philosophy of the interaction brain and mind, if I could hear correctly.
Yes.
Yeah, basically, this paradigm, brain-machine interface, was created with the goal to better understand emergent properties of the brain, properties that are generated by large populations of interacting neurons, brain cells. And we are very keen on this idea. That was the reason we created this paradigm. And we see consciousness and the mind as an emergent property of the interaction of billions of elements. And we don't know the mechanisms, we don't know the fine details of how that comes about, but that's a central question in modern neuroscience. I think particularly that we can only address that question by doing exactly what we are proposing to do, to measure the electrical and magnetic interactions of large numbers of neurons, hundreds of thousands of neurons. That way, you may be able to see and map and measure the emergence of these properties like the mind and consciousness. So I think that's the right pathway from a scientific point of view to pursue.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Plano, where we'll speak with Haseeb. Hi, Haseeb.
Hey, Chris, how's it going? I just want to say I love your show.
Thanks.
I listen to it as often as I can. And I love love the topic you guys is discussing. I had a couple of real quick questions. First off, let's see. Your speaker referred to helping paraplegics and paralyze patients walking in. Are you thinking that the applications of the technology that you're discussing, are they going to help those people use their own legs or use a separate set of legs again? Or would it help, or if it's someone that does not have your paralysis of the legs or the arms, would it possibly help to give them a third arm or a third leg? Or does that limb does not, or if that limb is not necessarily actually a hand, or they have like a third limb, and you know that has, for example, some kind of a tool on it, something they could use for their occupation, like something a physician would be able to use. Do you think that would be a possible application of the technology? And if so, do you see that as being the next kind of thing that jumpstarts or kickstarts the next level of the evolution of the brain?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Miguel?
Well, I think the caller touched on many ideas that different groups are pursuing all over the world. All of them are being studied, you know, very carefully. Our approach is in the first level, you know, to achieve that goal of making someone walk again. And I'm referring particularly to someone that is severely paralyzed from the neck down, for instance. You know, a patient like Christopher Reeve was. To do that, we are creating an artificial body. It's a robotic vest that we call an exoskeleton, you know, that the patient is going to wear. And this vest and all the joints and all the components of the vest will be controlled directly by the brain activity of the patient. So the patient will voluntarily control the movements of this vest, and this vest is going to carry the paralyzed body of the patient. That's, in my opinion, the fastest and the easiest way right now to restore mobility to these patients. But there are other groups that are studying the possibility of using this bypass, this electronic bypass, to record the brain activity, the same brain activity, and then send these signals back to the paralyzed limbs or the spinal cord below the level of the lesion of the patient. That is more difficult. It's going to happen one day, but it's more difficult. There's also people, and we are starting to collaborate with some of them, that are combining this interfacing capability, brain-machine interfacing, with potential treatments of the lesion at the level of the spinal cord with stem cell research. So you could envision in the future the patients receiving, you know, a stem cell treatment combined with this brain-machine interface to potentiate whichever connectivity they can regain by the, you know, injection of stem cells in the spinal cord. So there are many potential alternatives, and I think this field is growing very quickly. And actually, what he said at the end is one of the things that I discuss in the book, the possibility that in the short term, of course, brain-machine interfaces will be used for rehabilitation. But in the future, as we develop non-invasive methods to record large-scale brain activity, all of us will be able to interact with machines just by thinking. And that, I think, in the long run, will have a profound effect in the way evolution, you know, of our species unfolds.
What about people who are troubled not by paralysis or by missing limbs, but by excessive involuntary movement, things like Parkinson's disease?
Yes. We also have, in this research, developed a potential new therapy that uses a brain-machine interface to treat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. We have tested this first in rodent models of the disease, and we had a tremendous success. And this is a semi-invasive technology. You can implant a stimulator on the surface of the spinal cord. It's a very easy procedure that can be extremely easy to do anywhere in the world. It's going to be very affordable. And it has, so far in animal models, we just got some very promising data in primates recently that reproduced the data in rodents. We have shown that we can have the same effects of a previous technology called deep brain stimulation. So if that is confirmed in the primate studies that we are finalizing now, we would have a new therapy that uses the same concept of brain-machine interfaces to ameliorate the tremor and the akinesia, the lack of movements, and the difficulties in locomotion that Parkinsonian patients show. So there are now many different pathologies, neurological pathologies, and even psychiatric pathologies, in which scientists are looking for the applications, the potential applications of brain-machine interfaces for new therapies.
Is it possible to implant thoughts in another human being?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question. I always got that asked, particularly in high schools, when I go to talk to high school students that want to learn quicker and faster, including my own sons. So far, we have shown that you can send messages back to the brain. You can send simple messages like move this way, move that way, go ahead, select this texture. So we have just demonstrated that we can interact directly with the brain through a new code. We basically use patterns, spatial temporal patterns of electricity, small currents of electricity that we can deliver to the brain tissue, and we learned that with time, the brain will learn this code. It will decode the messages that we're sending. But these are very simple messages, nothing close to teaching the, you know, algebra to a brain in a few hours. Nothing like that exists. And it will take a while for, you know, something close to, or not even close to that to exist. But we have found that the brain can actually learn to decode the signals coming from an artificial actuator. And what that suggests to us is that we can completely free the brain from the physical constraints of the body. Hmm. So we can send brain activity to control device, and that device can report back to the brain without any interference from the body, which is already a pretty big step forward, I think.
My guest is Miguel Nicolelis, professor of neuroscience and founder of the Center for Neuroengineering at Duke University. His new book is called Beyond Boundaries, The New Neuroscience of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroengineer and neuroscientist Miguel Nicolelis, whose new book is called Beyond Boundaries, The New Science of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Miguel, I wonder what at this point, the biggest puzzles are to solve, the things that appear to still be impediments that no one has figured out even a potential solution to.
You mean in terms of connecting the brains and machines?
Yes.
Oh, wow, there are many, of course. Some of them, of course, are technical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you get these recordings to last for more than a decade? So if you have to do an implant in a patient like you do a heart pacemaker, you don't need to change these implants, unless something tremendously unlucky happens. So we are shooting for something that could last 1 to 2 decades at least and continue to provide day after day, thousands of recording signals, electrical signals that can be used, to control devices. The other is the computational tools that will allow these signals to be read and decoded very quickly, so that the patient can get used to this, like we get used to walk without even thinking or moving in the world without even thinking. So that computational interface has to be very smooth, and it has to, be portable, wireless, and allow the patient to do many things, not only the ones that he has trained extensively for. The other is to know better how the brain adapts to this new body, how it dynamically maps this new body, and what is going to happen in terms of functionality whether, you know, you can, as your listener said, expand and have bodies with more appendices than our own bodies. And finally, I think this paradigm allows us to basically at least approach this, you know, 200-year battle that exists in neuroscience for how the fundamental neurophysiological basis on how the brain operates. You know, we have lived for the last 100 years thinking that the brain operates through these modules, very specialized modules, that each one of them associated to a particular function. What I'm proposing is the other side of the story. You know, there was the underdog for the last 100 years, but it's now quickly getting to become, you know, the dominant view, that the brain actually is a continuum. It interacts. All these areas of the brain actually interact, and they're all multifunction. They're doing multitasking all the time. So I think this paradigm has the potential to address this question that has been really a major source of contention in the field, because we are moving towards a moment in which we are going to look at very large-scale brain activity in real time and be able to read it.
When we get to testing this technology on human subjects, is there reason to believe that the plasticity of younger patients would make them more successful in using it?
For some functions, we may have that. But we know now that plasticity continues to be present throughout our lives, that the brain continues to be plastic during adulthood. So we are counting on that plastic potential to help patients that, you know, have been living with disability for a long time and to help patients that are not, you know, teenagers anymore. So in experiments that we have done with adult monkeys, we have seen this plasticity unfold instantaneously. Hmm. And it continues for as long as we have followed these animals. So we are very hopeful that that is not going to be a limiting factor in the treatments. And I may point out that these treatments are going to come in different flavors and different applications. And I think in all of them, the consensus now is that plasticity is going to be the key element for the success of these therapies.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Jack in Greenville. Hi, Jack.
Hi. My question was just about recalibration, actually. I was wondering how much recalibration is necessary when bringing the analysis to a new test subject and in order to correctly analyze the data. And if this is a significant amount of recalibration, what will that mean when we see applications or commercial applications of the technology?
Yes, for each patient, we have now found that there are some algorithms, computation algorithms, that we can use from subject to subject. You know, the models can be used from subject to subject, but for each one, there will be a need for a calibration and a training of this computation algorithm. We have seen now, we started with large periods, long periods, you know, 30 minutes a day, but we have now decreased these periods to just a few minutes a day, and it's almost like a baby learning to walk again. You know, to walk for the first time, not again, to walk for the first time, is going to be an interactive process in which the patient is going to have to learn how to interact with a new body. And that process will, again, take advantage of the plastic potential of the brain, but also the adaptive nature of the computational algorithms. These algorithms can learn, and they can learn continuously, like a baby brain learns when it's mapping the world for the first time, by touching the world or starting to know his or her own body to move. You need a calibration for each individual, but that can be actually facilitated by the features of the algorithm that can learn continuously, but also how the brain plastically adapts to the new conditions.
Once again, back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Anita in Dallas. Hi, Anita.
Hi. In the introduction, I understood that blindness was also one of the concerns that the therapy might possibly address. I wondered if, Professor, you could speak to that.
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. There are many groups in the United States and in Europe. I just came from a meeting in Switzerland where that was discussed extensively, the possibility of creating prosthetic devices for treating blindness. There are people working on prosthetic devices for the retina, for patients that have diseases of the retina, macular degeneration, for instance. There are several groups. There are groups working on stimulating visual pathways, including the visual cortex, to try to restore some degree of vision. So this is an intense area of research, not only at academic level, but there are already companies developing devices and testing these devices to restore vision.
I'm curious as to whether you've been approached by NASA. You know, you think about, maybe I've just watched the movie Avatar 2 recently, but certainly you could construct some kind of a robot that was controlled by a human being and walk on Mars without ever risking a human life.
Oh, you just mentioned my dream. I'm a son of the Apollo generation. You know, even though I was growing up in Brazil, I was tracking every mission, every astronaut I knew by name. And so, yeah, I got some previous contacts from the European Space Commission, never by NASA, although they are aware of our work. But I mentioned in the books my dream that would be, on the coast of North Carolina, sitting, having my favorite book and my little drink next to me, while my brain controls a little rover on the surface of Mars and experiencing vividly what is to have a part of me on the surface of Mars, even though I'm on the surface of Earth. We actually have done an experiment with monkeys that simulate this by having a monkey on the east coast of the United States controlling the movements of a humanoid robot in Japan in real time. And, of course, we don't know what the monkey felt, but the principle was demonstrated. So, yes, I think that in the future, you will, if you want, of course, you don't need to send a human being to Mars or Venus. You can send a robot or even, a computational device and experience what is to be there on the surface of another celestial body just by sending your thoughts there and receiving feedback from that device directly to your brain.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jeffrey in Dallas. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. I wanted to ask the professor, I've got a condition called neurofibromatosis type 2, and oftentimes the hallmark of the disease is to grow benign tumors on the acoustic nerve. And one of the remedies is when it's time to resect the tumors to implant an auditory brainstem implant. Right now the hearing is limited in terms of, I don't have one, but what it computes and what the patient would hear, from what I understand, is certain tones and what have you, is if this research could enhance, either by calibration or software or what have you, the auditory signals that are received to be more accurate and more normal.
Yes, I just mentioned the meeting I was last week in Switzerland, and in that meeting I also participated in the discussions of groups that are working on new versions of the cochlear implant. And as you mentioned, in the case of your particular condition, working on developing new versions of the brainstem implant and even discussing the possibility of going all the way to the auditory cortex. So I have no doubt that this technology, even though the main focus of these experiments that I describe here in the book were for the motor system and the tactile system, but lots of what was discovered there can be applied to this new generation of cochlear implants that will be closed-loop control systems, meaning you won't only send signals to the auditory system, but you're also going to get some feedback information to calibrate it, to improve what is going on. And what I saw there, and in fact there was a discussion of a similar case, clinical case, is that there is a push to actually move from the inner ear to the brainstem and in the future to the cortex to improve the first generation of cochlear implants.
So one might argue that Americans with sound bodies don't need any more reasons to sit around and do nothing. But I'm curious if you can talk about day-to-day technologies. Would we, instead of moving a mouse, would we sort of think where we want our web surfing to go?
Oh, yeah. I think, in fact, all the major computing and web companies, Google, Microsoft, Intel, all these companies have now either divisions or brain-machine interface groups. discussing and experimenting with potential new ways to interface ourselves to our desktops, our computers, laptops, iPads, everything, just by thinking. This is going to come. You know, I just saw a couple of weeks ago an announcement of an application for the iPhone using EEG, electroencephalography. So electrical signals that you can record from the scalp that allow you to browse through the icons of the iPod without you moving, without you touching anything, just by thinking. Of course, this is still limited because when you record the signals from the surface of the scalp, you lose resolution, you lose the spatial resolution, and you can get very little in terms of useful control signals. But I'm aware of several groups here in the United States, several major companies here, and also in Europe, discussing this new type of interface that, as you said, will eliminate keyboards, mice, and will make you a part of the desktop. So you are going to assimilate the desktop as part of your reality, and that will make, you know, interacting with different programs, with different platforms, computational platforms, much easier and seamlessly than we do today, and faster, of course.
How long do you think it might be before this technology is available to people with severe disabilities and is affordable to average people with sort of average life and health insurance policies?
Yes, yeah, that's a big question. I think the next decade we'll see lots of these applications coming forward. We have a project, the Walk Again project. We aim for the next 3 to 5 years to make our first demonstration on a patient. In fact, I hope that if everything goes okay, that could happen on the opening game of the 2014 World Cup in Brazil.
Wow.
So have a Brazilian kid that has been quadriplegic walk into the pitch, into the field with the Brazilian national team and kick the ball for the opening kick of the ceremony. That's my, you know, childhood dream, and we have a shot of actually doing it. It's the, what I like to call the Brazilian moonshot. So I think we will see that happening in the next 10 years. The first applications will be expensive, of course, because you need to develop this thing. But since you have millions of people that will be affected and benefit from this, I think that, like in the Parkinson case, we may be talking from something that today costs tens of, or hundreds of thousands of dollars, the surgical procedure, to something that will cost a couple thousand dollars because the technique is so much simpler, so much easier to implant and to monitor. So that is the kind of thing that we'll see in the next decade. For the more applications in the computer world, it may take a while just because of the need of a non-invasive technique. But
I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm so sorry. The new book by Miguel Nicolelis is called Beyond Boundaries, The New Science of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Miguel, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.